The clerk will call the docket. You may proceed.
May it please the court, Carla Brown on behalf of Frances Robinson. We are here today asking that the grant of summary judgment as to Ms. Robinson's case be reversed and that this case be remanded for trial. As this court noted in McDonald versus Commonwealth, Virginia Code 274, Virginia 249, Code Section 18.2.344 still has efficacy and was not facially invalidated by Martin versus Zorro. 18.2.344 left public fornication between two unmarried people a crime. It's a crime in a public workspace. Under this court's precedent, the trial court must have erred, because in dismissing Frances Robinson's case, that decision cannot be reconciled against McDonald versus Commonwealth, which held that 18.2.344 was still constitutional as applied. It can't be reconciled against this court's decision in Mitchum versus Counts, and even the rationale for Van Buren versus Grubb. This case is about a refusal to submit to sexual conduct in a public workspace. This is what the Bowman exception was created for. What happened to Frances Robinson in her workplace essentially is this. In the appendix at 163, the Salvation Army's own human resources director testified that Frances Robinson brought her two excerpts of an audio tape where the HR director said, as best she could, and I quote here, on one of them was Joel, Ms. Robinson's supervisor, back to the quote, said something to the effect of, let me nibble on your ear. And in the second one was something about, can I be your Valentine? And the overriding picture for Ms. Robinson's case is that her supervisor was propositioning her so frequently and persistently that she decided to record it. And even after she decided to record it, she was able to capture him, continuing to persist, continuing to proposition her. Frances Robinson testified in her deposition, it's appendix 194 through 195, that Joel DeMoss asked her to freak being a verb, and was she a freak being a noun? And Ms. Robinson understood this to be sexual intercourse, someone who enjoys sexual conduct. Her words was promiscuous. Ms. Robinson testified she understood that it was like a prostitute. Joel DeMoss, in the workspace, was talking to someone on the phone. This is in Ms. Robinson's deposition, appendix 205, lines 18 through 206, line 3. He told someone on the phone that he was looking at prime rib and her name is Frances Robinson.
May I interrupt for a moment? But the state tort action, which was a tort recognized by the judiciary, not by the General Assembly, was never meant to be a Title VII, little Title VII in Virginia. So you have to find something that is a discrete violation of a criminal code provision that would actually fit the policies of Bowman. And without getting into much detail, the fornication statute has specific, even if it were to survive the constitutional attacks on it, has specific elements. And, for example, nibbling on the ear would not qualify to convict someone, even before Lawrence versus Texas, of fornication. So what is the best evidence you have, assuming the statute survives constitutional scrutiny, for an actual specific invitation for a quid pro quo relationship based upon fornication?
Well, it's all of these conducts in cumulative. It's him playing in the workroom a videotape of other people kissing. He's making his intentions clear that Ms. Robinson is to submit to this conduct with him or it'll be under threat of her job. And again, and the videotape is, it's in the appendix 130. He's gesturing to slap her buttocks at the appendix 127. He's mentioning cleavage to her when none is showing. He's clearly telling her that
right,
this is what
sexual
she
harassment is a horrid condition, and there are many statutes that go after it, including Title VII. But fornication is not the same thing as sexual harassment. Fornication is a discrete act. So, I mean, the first question I have with your case is, do we even need to get to the question of whether or not the statute has any residual constitutionality? The allegations don't get there anyway. That's my question.
Well, cumulatively, it's understood Mr. DeMoss is telling Ms. Robinson that she needs to submit to this conduct with her, this freak comment, meaning that that's sexual. And I would say 18.2.344 does criminalize this conduct. It discourages parties from inviting, offering to engage in fornication, and it discourages the receiving party from accepting the invitation to engage in fornication. That's the key with 18.2.344, is by doing that, it banishes this conduct from the workplace. It guarantees that employees don't have to worry about being propositioned to engage in sex in their workplace or worry about whether they can accept those invitations for sex. Under 344, to do so, to agree to engage in it or to accept the engagement would be fornication, and it would be illegal under 18.2.344. I would just say, Your Honor, this statute is just like other statutes that the legislature has passed. I look to 18.2.441, which is the bribery statute in legislative matters and other proceedings. And what that statute says is that not only is it illegal to offer a bribe in order to influence the court, an arbitrator, anyone else, a juror, it's also unconstitutional to corruptly accept a bribe in that scenario. And by doing that, we protect the sanctity or the impartiality of that legal proceeding, of court proceedings, of jury proceedings. And it's the same thing with 18.2.344. We protect, we guarantee that there's not going to be any public fornication because it criminalizes the conduct from both.
Public fornication, you mean fornication in public, not solicitation for fornication in public.
Well, in order to engage in fornication in public, there has to be two parties engaging in the act. So one is offering to engage in it. One is, even if we do that, one is accepting the engagement. In order to engage in fornication, there has to be an overt offer. It doesn't have to be verbal. It certainly can be established by conduct, and it certainly can be established by conduct in a situation where an employee supervisor is repeatedly propositioning her, repeatedly talking to her about sex, repeatedly asking her if she's a freak, so much so, again, that Ms. Robinson has multiple audio tapes of Mr. DeMoss engaging in this conduct, two excerpts of which she takes to HR, and HR can hear him asking, can I be your Valentine? Can I nibble on your ear? And then there's further conduct even after that as set forth in
but
the appendix.
Valentine has a, I don't see what that has to do necessarily with fornication. And so is the freak comment, is that the closest we get in this case to the statute? And then the other things are atmospherics that maybe create a jury issue?
I would say freak is one of, yes, the short answer would be yes, but he also is having her watch two employees engaging in conduct in the break room.
Kissing.
Well, yes, but he's clearly laying the groundwork for exactly what he wants. And again, this was a case that was dismissed on summary judgment. The record was never fully established. This trial court short-circuited litigation, but it's clear, I think, a reasonable inference from the record that's just before the court now, that Mr. DeMoss wanted to engage in a sexual relationship with Frances Robinson. She understood it that way. She brought her concerns to HR on those same grounds, and I think that's a reasonable inference.
And because there's a difference between unwanted flirtation and harassment versus outright proposals to engage in a sexual relationship. I mean, they're not necessarily equivalent, and that's the difficulty.
Well, that's correct, but in order to invite someone to sex, I don't think those words have to be made. It can be established by conduct that's
sure.
What you're looking for, in addition to the words here. And Ms. Robinson understood it that way, and again, that would be an issue for a jury to decide what was his intention there, but we never got that opportunity because the trial court granted summary judgment. And on this record alone, it certainly establishes the claim that Ms. Robinson's putting forward, that Mr. DeMoss required her to submit to sexual conduct. Again, it's the concern that she took to HR, as laid out in HR's human director's deposition, Appendix 163, and it wouldn't be a fair reading on the record to conclude otherwise. And
it's a very fair reading on the record that there's a prima facie case of a hostile work environment. I mean, it's a classic case of that. And if this were a Title VII case, you'd be in a very different situation. But as Justice McCullough is asking you, where's the reasonable inference that there is a demand for fornication, which was the predicate for firing her later, other than what you've given us?
Well, I think that what we've given the court is essentially the record, but Ms. Robinson understood that to be an invitation for sex. Again, she took that to Human Resources. He repeatedly propositioned her, so much so that we only have the ones that she recorded after that point going forward, but he's inviting her to engage in sexual conduct with him. She understood him to be inviting her to engage in sexual conduct and to do so in the workplace, and this is particularly the kind of conduct that 18.2.344 prohibits. And requires people not to engage in. And again, it doesn't need to be established just by words, but could also be established by conduct, which is the case.
So those comments suggest not only the act of fornication, but the act of fornication in a public workspace. Is that what you're saying?
I think in this conduct, all of this is in a public workspace. There's no other location where this conduct is occurring other than Ms. Robinson's public workspace. But it's yes.
The harassment's occurring in a public workspace, but are you saying that the reasonable inference is that the fornication implicit demand was for the act to occur in a public workspace?
Absolutely. And that's why he shows her what people are doing in the break room at that public workspace, the video of the two individuals kissing. Frances Robinson and Joel DeMoss, there's not a single thing in the record that would establish that they knew each other outside of work. This is totally a work relationship. It's completely a supervisor-employer relationship and nothing else. And for that reason, this could only be in the public workspace. And for that reason, we know that 344, that 18.2.344 lives on in that conduct. I mean, ultimately,
well, what about the questions about renting rooms and the suggestion about her place?
Well, he also makes comments about going to her place, but he also makes comments in the workplace about Frances Robinson and wanting to engage. He's never been to her home. He has no conduct outside of the workplace with Frances Robinson. The fact that he also invites her to engage in some conduct outside the workplace, some conduct in the workplace, still gives rise to public fornication. And Martin versus Zorrell was never intended to prohibit or preclude the application of 18.2.344 in the conduct where we're talking about a public workspace, public fornication. I would just note that after this court's ruling in Van Buren, and think Van Buren by citing back to Mitchum and citing back to the fornication statute without noting that it's abrogated, without noting that there's been any change, implicitly blessed the rationale in Mitchum. But after that, the legislature looked at Code Section 345 and ultimately repealed it. But even though 344 and 345 are right next to each other, the legislature left 18.2.344 as a code section. It has to have applicability. This is what 18.2.344 was for, and we're asking that this is an opportunity for the court to clarify that employees who are propositioned to engage in this conduct, even by the conduct of their supervisors, are protected under the statute, and they don't have to worry about accepting because their conduct is criminal under the statute. We would ask this case be remanded so that Ms. Robinson may have this case tried to a jury of her peers, the inferences that are clear on the record determined by the jury, and we would ask the case be remanded for trial. Thank you.
Okay.
And I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Ryan Ferguson. I'm with the law firm Sutliff and Holland here in Richmond. I represent the Salvation Army and Joel DeMoss in this case. Seated to my left is Scott Busby of the law firm Busby and Megan in Atlanta, Georgia. He is my co-counsel in this case. Before I get into the real substantive issues here, I feel compelled to say at the outset on behalf of my clients, including Mr. DeMoss, that we categorically deny the allegations in the complaint and as they have been presented here to the court today. That being said, even assuming everything in the complaint is true, appellant cannot state a claim for wrongful termination under Virginia common law. There is a single claim at issue in this case, and that is wrongful discharge in violation of Virginia Code Section 18.2-344. I may find myself referring to it as Section 344 in this case. That's the statute I'm referring to. Appellant has asserted various other claims throughout the case, but they have either been withdrawn or dismissed. So the only question is whether appellant has stated a valid cause of action for wrongful discharge in violation of Section 18.2-344.
Well, but the discharge would not be in violation of the statute, right?
Perhaps that's a shorthand way
of saying it. It's in as a Bowman claim based upon.
Correct. The discharge would be in violation of public policy as expressed in Section 18.2-344. That statute contains a single sentence. It reads as follows in its entirety: any person not being married who voluntarily shall have sexual intercourse with any other person shall be guilty of fornication. That's the entire statute. It reflects a single purpose: to prohibit sex between unmarried persons. It says nothing of coerced consent or non-consensual sex or anything of the sort. And appellant cannot cite any authority that it does. There's no case, there's no legislative history, there's no journal article, there's no internet blog, nothing to suggest that that statute addressed anything other than sex between unmarried persons. But even if it could, even if appellant could somehow establish that that statute embodied a public policy against coerced consent or non-consensual sex in the workplace, she still cannot fit her claim within one of the narrow exceptions to at-will employment that have been identified by this court, specifically in Rowan versus Tractor Supply Company in 2002. This court said that there are three, and only three, circumstances where a valid claim for wrongful discharge can be asserted under this Bowman exception. The first is where the employer violates a statutorily created right. That's the Bowman case itself, where the shareholders had a statutory right to vote their shares. The employer interfered with that right. That has not been pled here, and the facts certainly do not. The second exception is where a public policy is explicitly expressed in the statute. It is the public policy of this Commonwealth, too. That has not been alleged here. The facts certainly do not support it. The third and final exception is where the employee was discharged for refusal to engage in a criminal act.
I'm sorry, counsel. Did I understand you to say that there is no law in Virginia that the refusal to engage in the behavior in the 344 would be against public policy? Did I understand you to say there is no law in Virginia on that?
There is no law that has been cited in this case, certainly. Now, this
well, if it starts, if this whole train starts with Mitchum, wasn't the entire analysis under Mitchum with regard to 344 an unwanted request for sexual favors?
Mitchum did address Section 344, absolutely. Several years later in Martin versus Ahearle, this court explicitly ruled that it is unconstitutional to infringe upon the rights of private individuals to engage in consensual sex.
Of private individuals to engage in consensual sex. But we also said in Martin versus Ahearle that we were not addressing public fornication, prostitution, or other such crimes.
Absolutely, correct. Other such crimes, meaning other conduct that is criminalized by other Virginia statutes. Every example that this court provided in that case, public fornication, there is a separate statute for that. Prostitution, there is a separate statute for that. Sex with minors, there is a separate statute for that. Non-consensual sex, 18.2-61. All of those things are set crimes in and of themselves.
But if Martin set the stage, and in Martin it was the public policy to not coerce someone into having sex in order to keep their job, that was the public policy. Zaharl addressed a purely consensual relationship between parties. And so we were very careful to say we are not addressing non-consensual activity. Why wouldn't the public policy remain?
Well, it's important to note that Martin versus Hurl didn't come up in the context of a wrongful discharge claim. The question was whether the
No, I understand. I totally understand the facts of Martin versus Earl. I'm talking about the public policy underlying Virginia law of or the public policy that was originally raised.
And the public policy at issue here, that the only public policy that's important for this case is whether that statute still stands for the proposition that it is a crime to engage in fornication, which is sex between consensual sex between private consenting adults.
Counsel, is sexual harassment against the public policy of the Commonwealth?
It is, Your Honor, as expressed in the Virginia Human Rights Act.
Okay.
And that statute is a
I'm familiar with the Virginia Human Rights Act. If one engages in sexual harassment, the purposes of causing someone else to engage in a sexual act with them, is that act therefore consensual? So if I were to put pressure on someone to engage in sex with me, someone who is in the workplace with me, would that person, would the act be consensual, or would that person feel forced or compelled to do it?
That person might feel forced or compelled to do it. And again,
would that violate the public policy of the Commonwealth?
That would not violate the public policy of this Commonwealth as expressed in Section 18.2-344.
That's not my question. Would that violate the public policy of the Commonwealth?
As expressed in the Virginia Human Rights Act, yes, it would.
Okay, thank you.
Not as expressed in Section 18.2-344. And the legislature has explicitly stated in the Virginia Human Rights Act that that very type of quid pro quo sexual harassment that they are alleging should be addressed under Title VII under federal law. That's Section 2.23903.
That was quite a go-around, wasn't it, between the legislature and the Virginia Supreme Court on whether we could imply rights of actions from that statute that did not otherwise exist.
Indeed it was, I believe. But at this point, I can only go on what the statute says, and I can also refer to this court's holding in Miller v. CBAMP, 234 Virginia 462, where this court said, we're looking at the confines of this exception to at-will employment. At-will employment, I quote, is a settled part of the law of Virginia, and that we are, think it wise to leave to the deliberative processes of the General Assembly any substantial alteration of the doctrine. We have to look at the Bowman exceptions as they are expressed in Rowan versus Tractor Supply Company and other decisions from this court. And appellant has to fit her claim within one of those narrow exceptions.
Rowan did not overrule Mitchum.
No, it did not.
Okay.
And appellant relies heavily on Van Buren versus Grubb from this court in 2012. In fact, criticized the appellees for not addressing that issue in our briefs. Van Buren did not address the issue before this court today. Van Buren addressed a single issue that was certified to the court by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals regarding the liability of an individual supervisor under a wrongful discharge claim. In fact, this court went so far as to narrow the certified question that was presented to it by the Fourth Circuit because it said it was too broad as to be necessary to help the Fourth Circuit resolve it. I quote, "The question as posed encompasses a larger body of employees than is essential to produce a determinative answer in these proceedings." So this court said, we're only going to decide what is absolutely necessary for the Fourth Circuit to decide the case before it, which was, again, the question of individual liability. To frame that issue, this court gave a general overview of Bowman claims, noted that the plaintiff, Van Buren, was asserting a claim under the third prong, refusal to engage in a criminal act. And again, that's the exact language they used. The court cited Mitchum as an example, a prior example, of where the third prong had been relied upon. The court then stated, in this case, Van Buren has alleged a valid cause of action under that third exception, and rightfully so. In Van Buren, the plaintiff relied on two criminal statutes, the adultery statute and the lewd and lascivious conduct statute, and said, I have been discharged for refusal to engage in a crime. So the case did not involve Section 344. This court didn't even discuss Section 344. It addressed a narrow issue certified to it by the Fourth Circuit, further narrowed by the court.
It seems that, if I'm understanding your argument, the question before us is whether we should judicially create a tort for the first time in Virginia for sexual harassment in the workplace, when there's a federal statute that's been on the books for decades. The Virginia General Assembly has addressed the issue without providing an implied right of action, and there's no other suggestion in our code that there is such an action.
Absolutely. This court has examined Bowman several times since that decision, including Rowan Tractor Supply, including City of Virginia Beach versus Harris. The exception remains a narrow, every time this court addresses it, it is a narrow exception to at-will employment. They have to meet specific criteria as listed by this court in Rowan. This case simply does not fit within any of those confines. for whatever reason, and I'm not here to comment on that today, for whatever reason the appellant did not avail herself of her substantial remedies under Title VII. As a result, they've tried to shoehorn this case into a common law claim, and it simply does not fit. The only one they could possibly fit, and the one they alleged from the start of this case, was refusal to engage in a criminal act. They first relied on the adultery statute. It was then pointed out that neither of the individuals involved were married, so that was withdrawn. They also relied on the prostitution statute. That was dismissed by the court below. It's not before this court today. The only claim that is before this court is, was she discharged for refusal to engage in conduct that is made a crime by 18.2-344? The only conduct that is prohibited by 344 is sex between unmarried persons. And sex between unmarried persons is the constitutional right of every individual of the Commonwealth under Martin versus the Hurley. So it simply cannot form the basis for a claim of wrongful termination. For that reason, Your Honors, we would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the trial court below.
Thank you. Rebuttal, you have 1 minute and 51 seconds.
The Virginia Supreme Court looked in Martin versus Worrell back to Lawrence versus Texas. And in Lawrence versus Texas, 539 U.S. 567, the court noted that these rulings are meant to do nothing more than prescribe particular acts. We are speaking about the most private of private acts, sex, in the most private of private places, the home. That's not the situation that is before the court. This is the most public of public places, your workspace, amongst your colleagues, with your supervisor. And I would note that in Martin...
Can I interrupt you 1 second? So you keep coming back to that, and it's a great point that Lawrence versus Texas didn't wipe it out entirely, but just in a very narrow context. But if that's true, and if you're truly limiting, and I'm not suggesting you have, but if you're truly limiting your argument to that, then we have to have reasonable inferences that a fact finder could infer that the demand for actual fornication was a demand for actual fornication at the public workspace as opposed to somewhere else, private space. Maybe that's the reason you didn't go into federal court, because that would be immediately dismissed under a sexual harassment Title VII case. There's not enough basis for that inference. Is there something in the record that you think I'm missing in that?
No, I'm not sure that you're missing the record, Your Honor, but I think the cumulative picture and the inference that can be drawn and was drawn by Frances Robinson is that she had a supervisor repeatedly propositioning her, asking to engage in that conduct. The freak comment, certainly, she testified...
In that conduct at a public workspace?
She does not use the words public workspace in candor to the court, but there's nothing else is contemplated other than the public workspace except for the one comment that he asked her about renting a room from her house. But even on the free comment, he's making a comment about sex. He's doing it after repeatedly propositioning her. He's doing that repeatedly. She's recording it. He's making these comments. While one finder of fact may find that he was not inviting her to have sex, I think that's a strained proposition at this point with the record, but a juror could easily find that what Mr. DeMoss was requiring of Ms. Robinson was for her to submit to sex with him. This is the freak comment. These are the repeated comments, and this is what she understood and will testify and has testified that she understood it meant like a prostitute, was sexual in nature. So she's already testified, yes, that she understood that to be sex. And again, as to the location, there can't be any other place other than the workplace. And I would just note, although Justice Powell already raised this in Mitchum, in the same paragraph that the court mentions its police power, it says it's important to note, and this is Martin, it's important to note, I'm sorry, 269 Virginia 42-43, it's important to note that this case does not involve minors, non-consensual activity, prostitution, or public activity. This, in that same paragraph, again, our holding does not affect the Commonwealth's police power regarding the regulation of public fornication,
well,
which
counsel,
means...
Counsel, on the freak comment, I thought he said no one loves a freak more than he does and that they do not freak at the Salvation Army but could freak at her place.
And he also makes comments about whether she is a freak. That's why the...
Right, but I'm just asking about the question of...
He also makes that comment.
...the location.
Well, he also makes that comment. I will acknowledge that, Your Honor, and yes, that might relate to somewhere else, but the wouldn't be consensual in that context anyways. But beyond that, all of the comments that he's making, they're still made in the workplace, and they're still with the intent to carry them out. Other than that one comment, Your Honor, nothing else is mentioned that would relate to or take them out of the workplace.
Has she answered your question?
Thank you.
Your time has expired. Thank you very much. Call the next case.